On this episode of the People Stack podcast, Rob and I interviewed Dave Sobel. He is currently the host of the Business of Tech podcast. So that is currently what he's doing full time. He's making his living. He is making his money as a podcaster. And his former life was in the managed service provider realm. So he, as he explains, he talks about his career. He talks about what he's done and all of his wonderful experiences in the MSP realm. So he worked for an MSP, owned his own MSP, bought one, sold it. So he has a ton of experience in this realm. And one of the reasons why we wanted to have him on is because we have not talked enough about this particular realm, from the IT services realm, the managed service provider realm. So we talked about a number of different things, broadly speaking, about the intersection of business and tech. That is his sweet spot. So we talked about keys to success in running and working for a managed service provider. We talked about how to shift from anyone in IT being seen as a cost center to being a revenue generating center. We talked about the importance of people skills, the importance of business skills, the importance of financial acumen and being able to read a P&L. And we talked about risk management and security and how basically everyone needs an MSP. Not really, you know, STAR, but like a lot of folks are using MSPs right now. And there's so many people who are in this space, and you may be in this space and not even realize it. And we talked about the network of people and the network of fun things that are involved in being in the managed service provider realm. So there's the people who are the business owners and the people who are working for them. And then there's also the people who are helping them, like the trainers. We talked about learning and training and how that's at the heart of really so much in tech. We talked about being the customer's customers and really being able to zoom into that. And yeah, like I said, he also shared about his career path and how he ended up being a professional podcaster of all things. So you're really going to enjoy this regardless of whether you are in the managed service provider realm or not. Even if you're in, let's say, the software realm or somewhere else, you're going to be able to take what Dave has to share and learn from it and grow with it as well. So please enjoy this podcast. Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where I share insights on how to upgrade your career as a technical leader. I'm Jen Funk. I am a career coach and co-CEO of the People Stack, along with my husband, Rob Allen. If you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the People Stack, please check out our free training at training.thepeoplestack.com. You're going to learn the four strategic and mindset shifts that our clients have used to command 300, 400, 500K plus salaries as tech leaders while living lives of abundance, freedom, and joy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right. On this very special episode of the People Stack podcast, we have Dave Sobel with us. He is the host of the Business of Tech podcast and does a number of other neat, cool things as well, which we will get into. So excited to talk with you today, Dave.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is going to be great fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So by way of introduction, tell us just a little bit about what you do, what you're passionate about these days.
Sure. So I've been, for the last 4 years, I've been the host of The Business of Tech, which is a podcast delivered 6 days a week. So you get a daily news show on business days and an interview episode on the weekends. And what I focus on is the idea of the intersection of where technology and business meet for those who deliver IT services. I've spent the last 25 years in this space of the implementers of technology. I ran a managed services business for a decade. I was on the management team of two large software companies. I live and breathe all this. But for customers, I like to describe it this way. from Microsoft, for every dollar of revenue they do $8 of revenue around their partners, generally through services. And I focus on the $8 rather than the $1.
A great way to put it. I love that. Yeah. I'm going to kick it over to Rob, because I know Rob wants to ask about your background for watching on YouTube.
Well, we talked about one form of background. Now we need to talk about the other kind of background, because Dave, I see in the view here for our video watchers, a collection of really choice vintage systems and some maquettes or statues from other more recent games. I see a Mercy up there, an Aloy, a Widowmaker, I think a Hanzo and a Link over in the corner. Tell us a little bit about that collection first, please. And then we get that background.
I mean, I'm a geek. I've known I was going to be in technology since I was like 5. I mean, I got my first computer as a hand-me-down Commodore 64, and I learned to program on it. And I knew I was going to do technology from that. But as anybody who comes up in that, you know, the 80s is also probably a video gamer from that space. And I distinctly am. And both modern and vintage. I love to collect the old systems, make sure that I've got a working version of everything. I've got a working line of everything Nintendo's ever made. I've got a line of everything Microsoft's ever made, everything Sony's ever made, and a bunch of Atari gear and some other random stuff along the way. And I'm a modern gamer too. You know, I'm working my way through. I'm playing Mass Effect 3 right now because I hadn't played the trilogy. I just finished up Forbidden West. Like I'm all of that stuff. And I always think my office and my set ought to reflect who I am and all of these combinations of technology. And so like I've got, you know, my Commodore 64, that the monitor is my childhood monitor. Like that's the one, the original that I had growing up. The Apple IIgs is the first machine that my high school computer lab had that I learned to program on. And the gaming stuff is cool vintage stuff I've picked up over time.
Beautiful. I love that there are stories that go with the individual specific components that you have rather than just a generic collection that you picked up at flea markets along the way. That's great to see.
Yeah, everything is, to a certain degree, all the pieces are selected. Like they're, and I, you know, they're ones that I like. The computers for each of those, power glove, because didn't we all want one as a kid? Like the Virtual Boy, because it's just such a weird kind of cool piece, and we're coming back around to that. And the gaming ones are all generally characters that I've particularly loved from recent stories. You know, you mentioned Aloy. It's like those were two of my favorite games of the past 10 years, yes, story wise. So I had to indulge there.
Beautiful. It's a great collection. You'd mentioned about being part of the $8 portion. What does someone's involvement in the $8 portion need to net out so that they too can indulge in a collection that includes video game cabinets and wonderful statuettes of some of your favorite characters?
Well, so the area that I really focus on is this idea of managed services providers and those technology providers that work with businesses. You guys are spending a ton of time working with businesses. And anytime that I talk with somebody, I always answer the question of like, well, who helps with your computers? And for every business, there is an answer. And it can be anything from my cousin's nephew helps us out occasionally to we have a formal engagement with an organization or we have internal staff. I focus on those formal companies that deliver this. And the basic idea is that for most small business owners, they don't have the capacity to know technology, to keep up with everything. They need a help desk. They need security help. They need investments in the core technologies to help them grow their business. And they should generally work with some provider. I ran one of those businesses for a decade, know a thing or two about how to do it, and then additionally helped, you know, for another 8 years, sold software to those companies. So with their enablement. So now I think about the like, well, what are the current trends? What are the technologies that we're talking about? And what are the next opportunities that they need to think about? Most of this space is small companies. Interestingly, 87% of this space does less than $10 million a year in revenue. So they're small companies, small, mid-sized organizations. That comes with all the joyous chaos that is small business, which I love, but that means that they are, you know, resource constrained, time constrained, money constrained, and so they have to do a lot with very little.
Wonderful. So for us old timers who have only tertiarily interacted with MSP, where are you drawing the line between classical project-based consulting and staff aug types of things that, you know, thousands of tiny consulting companies around the country are engaged in, and something that's more of a complete managed service provider?
It's a great question. So I like to think about it from the fact of what is the service list that we're defining. If you're simply coming in and doing pure, I will provide a body that fits a job description, that's an ancillary connected space, but less of what I'm focused on, because that's more a human resources. I will hire, recruit, and place the right people versus I'm going to deliver a set of services that are connected to your business. And I'm going to measure that in various ways. Could be measured on time, but more commonly it's measured based on business outcome. Like, I'm going to deliver these services, this level of uptime, this level of engagement, these business outcomes. We're going to measure it against revenue growth or cost cutting or whatever that might be. That's the space that I think is a lot more interesting, because it's a very clear value add. And for most companies, I really don't think they should have internal staff, because it's in that bit of you aren't that core business and you should focus on your core. And while technology is a core bit, you're going to need to have a whole bunch managed by people that think about it all the time.
Absolutely. I don't want to trust a bunch of paralegals to the law firm's email security and long-term infrastructure aspects. Definitely, definitely outsource that. If you're here listening to this and you're trying to run things in-house and it's not your core competency, stop.
Well, and it's so much more dangerous now. Like, I mean, so I started my first managed services provider in 2002, right? And it was a joyous time to start technology, right? Because it was so optimistic and everything was really great. And the biggest risks we were dealing with was Janice in accounting deleting something, or an old-timey virus, right, that might slow you down or bog down your computer. But now, particularly when we think about this from a security perspective, the adversaries are really sophisticated. And I don't think enough small business owners understand what we're fighting on the other side of this. I always like to describe it as Tony Soprano with a laptop. Like, this is organized crime that's built an entire system of this. They outsource it. They run customer support desks. They run a financial group. They have PR groups. Like, it's fascinating to me that actually, like, they will promote and do data statistics to promote their successes. Like, literally have a PR and marketing firm for more recruitment. They're smart enough to develop development teams and deployment teams. And they even think of it breaking out sales teams, meaning that they will get people that do find the victim and get paid for the victim identification. Like, it's so sophisticated, everybody. Like, really, we need to admire their savvy as business owners to really respect the adversary, and they'll get you. And I laugh and go, every business owner I talk to always says, oh, you know, I don't have anything of value. These hackers are like not going to steal anything of mine. And I laugh and go, yeah, you've got money, right? Like, they're coming for your money. They want to steal your data. They want to ransom it back to you or extort you by saying you're going to put it online. And they want you to pay them. And by the way, their customer support agents are ready with a toll-free number to take your and to teach you how to give them Bitcoin. Like, it's that good.
Yeah. And it's the Sopranos, you know, old school mafia shakedown is exactly the right mindset to go into this with, where the mom and pop bakery and the corner shop are exactly their targets for exactly that reason, because they want to interrupt your business, which is going to have a huge impact on you. They're going to copy any data that they can accumulate, and then they're going to sell that on the back end. So they're getting double juice for everything that they extort. So you're absolutely going to be a target at some point.
Oh, totally. So, yeah, it's literally is just a matter of time, right? Like, and anybody who lives and breathes security will tell you that it's a when, not an if. Like, they define it that way. And we built, you know, very well put together incident response plans and think about this. And I always say, like, look, we could talk security for ages and all of the details of this. And I'm super practical about this. I actually sort of, the security person who talks to says, I loathe this whole space. Like, I don't like talking about security because I didn't get into technology to fight off criminals. I got off into technology to build cool stuff and help people like advance their business. And I'd much prefer to spend my time talking about the cool stuff we can do with technology to like enhance your top line or do better customer service. But this is the baseline that we have to establish, and you got to at least do the basics before we can even get to the cool stuff of what we need to do. And that's what I mean. Like, it's gotten so much more complicated because it's so much more capable.
Wonderful. Yeah.
It's a really good point about the security piece of it. I wanted to ask about the running the business, working for an MSP aspect of it. So yeah, Rob is giving me the floor. Awesome. We have our sort of back and forth dance. Sometimes it works. Sometimes we trip over each other, but we make it work. So
it's where I wanted to go to next to.
Yeah. So where we're going next, the next moves, what I'd love to talk about, because a lot of our listeners, I know that what we just talked about resonated with a big percentage of our listeners, because either they work for an MSP, know someone who does, maybe want to build their own, or like has family members or friends who own a business who should be hiring people like this. So it's really relevant. So let's talk more specifically to folks. So we have clients, and so therefore I know we have listeners who work for MSPs and or have the desire, or maybe already want to build their own and like start their own business. So let's talk about this from the running and working for the IT managed services industry. I know that you probably have more than like lots of awesome stuff to share about that, Dave. So the way I'm going to frame the question, and I know it's probably a really hard question to answer, it's just to sort of spark the conversation. What would be the keys to success to running and working for a managed service provider?
It's a great question. And in a way, it almost depends really on where you are in your kind of journey of this, because the conversation I have with people that are running established providers looks really different than the ones who might be considering starting one today. You know, because there's an interest, you know, the approach is really different. If you're running an established managed services practice, you know, you're doing $500,000, $2 million in revenue, like your business is going to look different than somebody who's coming and saying, hey, I'm really interested in getting into this technology space for small business. What would you do? Like, my answers are really different for the two. But it actually starts with something that is common to both, which is understanding what the value is to the business and measuring it against your customer. I think we spend way too much time on speeds and feeds and cool tech. And by the way, I will nerd out with the best on this stuff. But from an actual what we spend our time in business, I really want to spend my time on one of three things. And I actually sort of call it my good, better, best model of technology. And the good is, hey, this is a thing we all need. We've all agreed this. You got to have technology, right? We can't run a modern business now without, you know, computers, the internet, your smartphone. Like, there's a whole bunch of basic stuff. And if you're managing that very basic need, that's good. Like, it's great, right? It's right in there, but it's a good offering. And you live in that SG&A administrative costs line item in somebody's profit and loss, next to rent, next to insurance. Like, you're right in that bundle. And business owners go, okay, great, that makes sense. That's a good offering. I think it's better when we actually start helping business measure impact to cost of goods sold. Like, can we actually make a difference in the delivery of your service? Can we reduce costs? Can we make your people a little bit more efficient? Can we figure out things that match against cost of goods sold? That's better. But I like to build really good businesses. So my best is when we play up in the revenue line, like when we're actually able to use technology and impact revenue. I quip with the MSPs all the time. I said, I can't find an owner yet that won't spend a dollar to make $1.25. Like, and if you can do that with your technology, you know, printing money, man, the money machine just opens up and they will invest in any technology you bring. And so you should be bringing technology solutions that help them drive their bit. And what do I mean by that? Like, it all depends on the industry. My area of expertise for my MSP was associations and not-for-profits. That tends to be measured in donations, membership, the ability to raise their money for their association, engage with their members. So if I could show them by this investment in technology that they could get 10% more members or drive 15% more donations, they would happily spend that money. And the value that the best providers and MSPs bring are the ones that connect to their customer's business and answer that question.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Yes. All the way. this is often in different words, but it's a similar tune that we sing to our clients who are in, they might identify as being in IT or working for an MSP or in consulting or something in this realm. And they just can't stand the fact that they're treated like a cost center. And how can I move from being treated like a cost center to not? Okay, so, well, first of all, what's the not? Well, yeah, you're generating revenue. And so what have been the best pieces of advice, best pieces of inspiration that either maybe you've given or heard from others that you would give to our listeners that are in this spot where it's like, oh man, I hate being a cost center, whether it's the business owner or someone working in this sort of realm? What would you say to them to start making that shift to generating revenue?
Yeah, yeah, you've got to make the realization that you're a business analyst now. That, I mean, and for too many of us in the technology space, we love the geeky stuff, right? Like we play with this stuff because of we love the shiny, or we want to play with the new tech, or we want to, you know, like, but actually right now, technology is advanced enough and mature enough that you need to bring business analyst skills to the table. And if you can't do that, you are going to live down in the cost line items. And I'm just sorry, listen, like, sorry, MSP, that's the way it goes, because technology is now not a, you know, sort of a want or like a dream. It's just a must have. It's not a competitive advantage to have the internet or to have good computers or to have like a basic operational network. Like, that's table stakes, everybody. Like, that's just done. And by the way, I can get like incredibly powerful systems just off the shelf with good software as a service solutions now, which was hard before. And a lot of people have not made the transition to think that way as technology providers. Like, it, you know, yeah, that's why I talk about the difference between sort of new business and old business. And I like to think a lot about the 20 somethings that start businesses, because it's a great mindset to get into. Somebody who's starting up right now is going to go spin up a whole bunch of cloud services really fast and have everything instantly.
Yeah.
You're going to have a full-featured productivity stack, communication stack, CRM. Like, you're going to have billing capabilities. You're going to have credit card processing capability. I mean, you're just going to spin all that stuff up with a couple of credit cards and a couple of clicks. It's great.
Bang, bang, boom.
Right. It's amazing. It's what a lifetime to be alive. Right. But the bits there of running it aren't as important. It's about selecting the right ones and making sure that they're connecting and that I can get the data out of it and that it's driving to what that business owner wants to accomplish. And that's all business analysis.
I love, love, love any opportunity to be able to highlight the business analysts out there, because they are woefully underpaid and underappreciated for the level of impact that they have. A good BA on your team keeps you from wasting time on things that are just not necessary. They understand both sides, the business and the technology capabilities, and they marry the two in a seamless way. And if you aren't listening to your BAs, well, you're wasting money somewhere. And it's not on the BA.
Not generally, no.
Not generally. Yeah.
So that's my number one advice, is that you need to lean into that. And by the way, I want to acknowledge it's hard. I get it. For a lot of the people that live and breathe this space, they are technologists first. They started that way. The skills may not come naturally. You know, oftentimes you chose technology because you didn't have the gift for gab, or you didn't have the communication skills at the same level. And I don't want to devalue your technical skills, because they're super important. But what you're looking to do is to bridge the gap between the business people and the technology. That's the actual value.
So let's take a moment to focus in on the individuals that work for an MSP. Now, for a lot of folks, the structure to move from, you know, junior software engineer through software engineer or help desk person up to, you know, director of cloud services, is a fairly straightforward path when you're internal to a software organization or another organization that has that sort of defined understanding built in. How do individuals set themselves apart and rise through in a fulfilling career as members of an MSP?
It's a great question. And it actually parallels a lot more than you might think, particularly over on like the software side. And you find that often it's the people that are advancing are the ones that learn two basic skills. The first is that they're going to learn people skills. They consider becoming managers. They learn the people skills to be good managers. It's not just a matter, that's just a matter of time, but actually how to manage people, how to communicate, how to empower others to make them effective. And then the second part is those that can distinctly tie back the work that they do out to business requirements. And I mean that in the broadest sense, right? Even someone at the, you know, who is an entry level person who can make the connection between the work that they're doing on help desk tickets and the outcome to the business, those are the people that do really well. And they do really well quickly because they understand inherently how to prioritize what's important to the customer, how to communicate well to be effective from the customer perspective. And those are the skills that are going to advance you more quickly to be able to get into those higher value roles in an organization.
I feel remembered you if you were in our course, but you sound like you've been in our course.
I was thinking the same thing. Let's talk about just about the ladder a little bit. I was almost going to ask what's the typical career ladder, but I know there's no such thing as typical, but like what might be one career ladder where someone might start, I don't know, let's say they're starting out in help desk or something like that. And then maybe they manage people who are running the help desk. Where can they go from there?
Well, there's a couple of paths, right? So you can kind of go as typical, the technical or the people path. You know, you may be a junior help desk person, tier one, doing, you know, basic entry level tickets. They're the joy of fixing printers and helping people with basic crashes. But then you'll move on to more advanced work, right? The more senior, you know, the tier two technical work. And then you might move into tier three implementations and project work and the kinds of advanced technology implementations, and you'll go that route. And then at some point you may decide that you're going to want to move beyond that into the business analyst side and combine the two sets of skills. But there's a long line of you know, for those that are individuals with technical background, you can also then of course go into from, you know, the leadership role. So you can go from a, you know, a tier one tech to a team lead and to a coordinator, to a project manager. You know, you can go the person version of the route. And by the way, I find that those that really want to be, you know, a bit of masters of everything, you know, they are not mutually exclusive. You can do both, and you can grow yourself out and advance your technical talents while at the same time investing in your people skills. And though you can find that you can do both, and you can be a large team lead on large projects, right, and be able to do project management and technical work and be a deep dive tier three all at the same time. And it's a matter of balancing that capability. I tend to think that, you know, it's a combination of two things. It's the individual driving their own career, but also a good organization that's backing them up and giving them good career paths.
Yeah, absolutely. And because a lot of our listeners are mid to upper level managers and they're wanting to break into that upper level, can we zoom in a little bit more about what are the possibilities beyond, like, so you mentioned like project management, right? So in the people realm, so a lot of our listeners are also listening to us, people stack, because we talk about people stuff, right? So what might be one path to get to like higher, like really upper level management and higher level management in the people realm, people management realm?
Yeah, I mean, it's from my perspective, and I definitely don't position myself as an HR expert, but having built out a couple of organizations and managed teams, you know, my experience on this is that, you know, it goes the route of, you know, when you're trying to look for advancement is the ability to go from manager to more director. And I think that the difference there is managers tend to focus a lot on the people side of things. And as you move towards director, it's people plus money. The ability to actually not just manage the people, but the impact of those cost choices on the organization. And the more you are able to manage those two traits is where you might move into much more senior management. You know, the difference between a regular manager is the person who's good at managing all the people, but doesn't really think much about the costs of choices. But the person who gets the director title, that's the person who can actually manage the budget and actually understand how to deploy capital resources as well as people resources.
Yeah, that's absolutely what we've seen from our perspective as well. So for example, working with clients in all of those realms and on up to like vice president or even C-level, the difference that we see, and I really want our listeners to really take this in, like especially if you're a manager, senior manager, and maybe even a director that wants to go higher, the difference that I see if I were to take the classic client who's a manager, look at their resume versus the classic client who's successful and still wants to move up more, and it is already a director or is a VP, is exactly that. It's the money. It's show me the money, baby. It's like, how is this having an effect on revenue? And so when we get a client who comes in and their resume is all about save this multiple million dollars in revenue or brought in this client, which brought in an additional X percent and blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, cool. That's the level that we're playing ball at. So for all of you who want to get into that field, it's like, it's about exactly what you're talking about before, the business analyst, the business acumen, financial acumen. So we work with clients a lot on this, but I'd love your perspective on this, Dave. Let's say it's someone, just for context, who's been in the people management realm for a bit, you know, 5 years, maybe even 10 years, and wants to move into director VP level and doesn't really know where to start in terms of developing that business acumen, financial acumen. What could be, from your perspective, whether it was in running your own businesses or in managing people who have done this, what's a place to start? You know, like, I know people are like, oh, is there a course that I could take? Like, I don't know, maybe. But what wisdom would you share in terms of beginning to gain that business acumen and financial acumen?
It's really funny because I literally just answered this question. I was on a panel back. I went back to my university for homecoming and was literally asked this question by students. And it's exactly the same answer. It's the learn to read a profit and loss statement. Like, cool. That's the base of it. And I literally told a bunch of college kids, I was like, the one thing I want you to all do is go find that one class that teaches you to read a profit and loss. I didn't when I was a student, and I wish I had. It was literally the one regret I have for my educational experience was not learning that soon enough. And it matters at almost every point of the career that we've just talked about. Like, literally the person who understands a profit and loss statement and can talk about the basics of business, even just the very basics, goes so much further. And I don't think we give enough credit. Like, businesses are machines designed to produce profit. Like, that's what they're for. And there is a system to manage to that. It's called the profit and loss statement. And everything is that fundamental. Like, we can overcomplicate everything. It literally boils down to this. And if you can manage those levers, even at a very basic level, that's the beginning. And you'll get better at it. Over time, you realize all the subtleties that go to driving that machine. But at its very basic, it is really just a simple math formula. And for anybody who's starting out, I say, learn the math formula, understand the basics, and then work your way from there.
I love that. That was one of the first things that I did when we started a business. And it wasn't like that somebody told me. It was like, oh man, what is profit? Like, I thought I knew what it meant, but I wanted to make sure that I really knew what it meant. So I started Googling, and what did I get? A whole bunch of profit and loss statements. So I basically taught myself to read them. And then through a combination of talking with other business owners, like, oh, that's what that means. And that's, and you know, so that I love that advice. It really is that simple if you're just starting out, and it really will differentiate you from the other techies, from the other even people managers who are either scared or don't want to, or are resistant to talking about it. If you're open to talking about money, yeah, I love that.
Oh, yeah. And we all get funny about it too. Like, we have a lot of social norms around not talking about money and stuff. And it's anybody who's entrepreneurial realizes real quick, oh yeah, I better be comfortable talking about money. Like, I have to be good at asking for it. I have to be good at managing it. I have to be really open about my situation. Like, you've got to get over all of that stuff real fast or you are in trouble. And that entrepreneurial streak is, even if you're not going to do it on your own, having just a little bit of that and understanding the basics, wow, it goes so far.
Love it.
Yes, absolutely. So we talked a little bit about, you know, starting up. When you think about bringing a new MSP to bear in the current market, you know, I think of MSPs and I think of, you know, 20, 30 year old firms that have been around forever, and they've got a couple of guys who started in their 20s and are still at it, and they've got, you know, a couple of dozen folks working for them. I think of hundreds of those in every state, in every city, in every county. How do you make a splash to bring a new one to bear? Do you have to have a new service like AI, or does it have to be some other differentiator?
A really interesting question. And your timing is impeccable, because this is literally a question that I'm working on my own show. Is one of my most popular pieces of content I've ever made. It was, if I was starting an MSP today, what would I do? And I released it a couple of years ago. So I'm working on the 2023 version of it. So I'm kind of updating 3 years later. And it's really interesting to see how my thinking on this has advanced. If I was telling somebody to start something new, I think I actually would tell you, no, don't start an MSP. But this is what I mean by that. A traditional MSP comes with a lot of thought and stereotypes and defined ideas that you will be involved in the core technology delivery, cybersecurity delivery. Here's a defined stack of stuff. And I think a new business needs to lead. Note, I didn't say exclusively, but lead with what I call stuff higher in the stack. I want you to actually live up in the productivity layer. The networking stuff, the security stuff, like that's all just table stakes stuff. I want you to actually live in the high value stuff, which is the technology of the way people do business. And that's things like workflow management. It could be robotic process automation, or it could be AI ethics implementation and framework implementation. I really think this is going to be a big deal, a big offering in 2024 and 2025, is companies that help you with defining which ethical framework you're going to use for AI implementation in your firm. Because AI is amazing, and wow, it opens up so many interesting, difficult questions about where the lines are and how you use it well. Because there's a lot of ways to use it really badly.
So the way you're describing that, it kind of overlaps into the fractional C-suite, fractional type of work that we're seeing. When you go from just like a fractional individual who's, you know, sometimes a VP for people, what would it be to just be a whole ass MSP for that?
Yeah, and it's funny, because this is where I get my little sort of get on my soapbox and go, like, I don't want to get wrapped up in all these titles, like, and all the, like, I want to actually define what the role is really well and what the offering is, and you'll figure out the way to do it later. And I think one of the things that I push back on a lot is we in technology quickly get to acronyms and weird titles. And I mean, what's the difference between a CTO and a CIO and a CISO? Particularly when you're dealing with a business that is, say, sub $10 million in revenue, it's like, who cares? Like, why don't we actually just define the problem we're solving really well and be really clear about that and speak in clear business terms rather than gobbledygook acronyms and define the meeting? And I look at it and say, like, what I really want to help implement is good frameworks for people to leverage the technology correctly. And I mean that ethically, securely, you know, in a way that gives good outcomes. And you can understand everything I just said in that definition without having to define it by a bunch of these terms. And I don't want to get too wrapped up in the terms. And I want to be really clear with what the offering is. So your question was like, well, what would I build? I'd build a really clear way of helping customers navigate this stuff, their technology needs. I'd be pretty holistic about it. It's a technology service, and let's focus there.
Beautiful. When you think about talking to customers about some of these needs, some of these requirements, how much education do you need to do around why these are real needs, and how much of it is already part of their awareness?
I think we need to assume nearly no awareness and always assume that we need to do tons of education, because this technology moves pretty fast, right? And it's getting faster, and it's a lot to keep up with for those of us that drink from the fire hose daily, much less to assume customers are even close to this. And I want to go so far as to actually say, I think that's actually your core value is the training and education you do on an ongoing basis. And I think we too often dismiss that as just sort of like, oh, well, you need to do that as part of the sales process, or occasionally we'll train them. It's like, no, I actually think continuous education of our customers, teams, management team, implementers, like that's actually the core offering. Like making sure that they're informed and educated on a very regular basis is something they'll pay for. And I think they'll engage with more regularly. And we want to make that the core offering or part of the core offering.
I've hired more consultants as educators first and then service providers second than just straight out service providers. So totally rings true.
Yeah. And I'm finding some of the most successful MSPs that I talk to hire trainers. Like actually have like educational teams that like that's what they're doing. And I'm seeing it's a mark of kind of best in class is like I always know, like, oh, you know, when somebody tells me, oh, I've got three trainers on my team, it's like, oh, you're doing pretty well, aren't you? You've got this nut cracked. And I think that that's a core offering. So I'm totally with you.
Beautiful. So where do you go from here? You have the different types of MSPs that can be started. You have the different types of career paths throughout an MSP. If you're a person for whom this really jives with, what do you do next?
It depends on where you're coming at this, but you know, I think the other bit is engaging the right one. If you're a small business owner, understanding which one to engage with, you're looking at it from a career path, understanding where you want to come in. You know, for somebody who's asking me about skills right now, there's two categories that I always talk about from an entry perspective. Cybersecurity is a pretty obvious one. The second one I think is going to be AI. And it's all about, and for me, it's much more about proper use and understanding the ethical frameworks. Being able to give good advice about the way these systems should work and how we measure them and we understand them is exactly what it is. And I'll give you my sort of literally most recent example. New York City just did a huge bunch of announcements about they're putting forth their AI plan and the way they're going to roll it out and all the guidance for employees. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. That's exactly the kind of work I want to see. Like, I want providers to do that. And then the mayor also managed to slip out that he's using deepfakes of himself to communicate in multiple languages with constituents. And it's like, oh, okay. Right. It's like, oh, that's a good idea to use AI, but wow, we're misrepresenting you and your capabilities by, you know, you don't speak Hindi and you don't speak like Mandarin, but wow. Okay. That's a problem. You've opened up an ethical can of worms at the same time as you're putting forth your plan. And literally in the same story, I can show you the good and the bad and where the opportunity is. Like, I want more of the planning. I want more of the guidance. I want to give people the direction. And wow, please keep them from doing these things that are like the confusing, unethical stuff. And businesses want that advice. They want the guidance. They want someone to help them to navigate what these technologies are good and not good at doing.
Thanks for giving me this quick moment for our sponsor, Coverage Cat. We're very intentional about who we allow to sponsor the PeopleStack podcast. And when I connected with the folks at Coverage Cat, I quickly learned that they are an excellent fit as a sponsor. If you live in Washington, California, Texas, New York, or Florida, Coverage Cat is a free concierge service that will help you find the best price and coverage for your umbrella, car, home, and renter's insurance. And yes, loyal tech leader audience, we know that most of you need insurance, whether it's umbrella or other insurance to protect your wealth. We know how annoying dealing with insurance companies can be. So we love how Coverage Cat is making this process super easy. Fill out one form and they compare across dozens of carriers to find you the best coverage and price while you skip the spam and sales calls. Get your free optimized insurance quote today at coveragecat.com.
There is a wide defining or wide division between what they're good at doing and what they're not good at doing. And it's very easy to blur that particular line, and keeping up on top of how blurry that line is a full-time job. So yes, absolutely. Security is very much the same type of thing, where what is perfectly safe and best practices today is the vulnerability that gets you owned tomorrow. So when you're thinking of an organization, what's the allocation for one and the other that you would see a successful organization getting into?
I wish I could say I have a complete guidance on this. What I actually want to guide and tell people there is that this is a risk management exercise. And everybody's risk tolerance looks a little different. And what risk you're willing to take versus what you're not, and how much you're willing to invest to protect against that. I'll give a classic, simple example to this. The CIA, they're willing to invest a lot, right? An awful lot in data protection, data privacy, highly complicated systems to protect very important secrets. And we want them to lean into that. A small business who isn't necessarily have a lot of unique IP, protect the crown jewels, right? And make sure that you have a really good incident response and really good backups. And you've done the basics on preventing against phishing attacks. And by the way, we can prevent like 90% of attacks with just a few small things. Literally, I can tell people that if you're good at backups and you're good at making sure that you're using proper multi-factor authentication, or ideally moving to like pass keys and physical keys, and you do like a good incident response plan, you can actually do really well with just those basics. Like, you don't need a ton. But it's risk management, and it's about where that investment is, because if you're really small and you only have a few dollars, I want to make sure they're spent on just the core things that are valuable. But as you get bigger, you're going to have more risks that would take down your business, and you're going to want to protect against those.
Excellent. This being the people stack, we want to talk about people and the properties of people that allow them to thrive in this kind of environment. And what would be sort of, I don't want to say personality traits, but when you meet somebody, how do you know that they might thrive in one of these roles?
For those that are delivering services, I am very big on those quote unquote soft skills, which is a horrible name, but it's like, are you a good communicator? Are you a good team player? Are you insightful? Do you ask good questions? And I am less focused on technical skills, particularly because in our current environment, we're so short on technical people. And I was kind of sort of build versus buy. I'd rather hire smart people that ask good questions and teach them more technology than find the expert technologist who can't communicate with anybody. Like, that person's not really as useful, particularly when we're in a services business, right? And where service is such a part of it. That highly technical person without communication skills may do really well in large enterprise IT or delivering an IT. That may be where they thrive. But in this realm where it tends to be smaller, more dynamic, and we need such customer service skills, I'm going to lean into all the soft skills, but I'm going to encourage employers to know that you're going to have to invest continually in your people. And I think most of the time I see this in almost every technical organization I talk to that have reasonably unrealistic expectations, both on the hiring of technology skills, but also the ongoing maintenance of those skills. Like, this is hard stuff, everybody. You got to keep up with it. And if you're not investing in your people, they are getting stale from the moment you hire them, and you have to be competitive, and that's your core bid. And, it's the old classic, like, well, if I train them and they leave, it's like, well, what if you don't and they stay? Like, it's literally that cliche, everybody. Like, you're going to have people getting stale on the shelf. So I'm going to encourage employers to know you got a budget to keep people's skills going. It's just part of the game.
I love Absolutely. That you said this, because we've said it so many times to clients when people ask questions, so it's sort of like it's a validation, and in hearing it in your own way, hearing it in your words, I know that that's going to resonate for many of our listeners, including clients, including future clients, that it's what I hear you saying is that at the end of the day, tech skills do matter. However, the people skills, the soft skills are actually what matter more, because you could always, it is a matter of keeping up with the tech, right? Especially if it's like whatever industry that you're in, there's a certain level of competency that you're going to need to maintain or get ahead in. Okay, cool. That's great. But would you rather work with someone who has zero people skills and is like the best coder or help ticket person or whoever it is, or is like, you know what, they're just so fun to hang around with, have emotional resilience and have emotional empathy and all of these kinds of things. And it was like, you know what, I don't know how to do that yet, but I'm willing to learn. I'm going to pick person two every single time over that first person who's not willing to learn the people skills because they're learnable as well. And also all these other skills that we're talking about as well, like the money skills and the business skills. Like,
right.
If you're open to learning it, that's really what makes a difference, because a lot of people aren't.
No, I keep saying this to anybody that says, like, employers, remember, you have to spend some money here. Like, just going to call out, like you have to do that. It is part of the game. If you don't, your people get stale and you lose competitive advantage. That's how it goes. And assuming that they're going to do all of that work, like, it just, that's just not the way this is going to work out for you. You know, like, yes, I'm sure there's an exception or two out there. And I'm sure there's somebody who said, well, figured it out. Okay. But let's for a moment assume you are not that one exceptional weird company that figured it out. Like the rest of us, you're going to have to actually continually invest in your people in order for them to keep up.
They're paying for it one way or another. Whether they're paying for it in attrition, where they're paying for it in defects and other misses in their solutioning, if they're paying for it in speed to market, if they're paying for it in being able to bring in new people, if they're the money's going out the door one way or another. You just got to find where it is and reroute it to where you actually want it to be.
And you said it, like, in a way, like, I would rather spend it, know it, and have it on my P&L as like an asset versus it going out the door through some mysterious loss, right? Like, I'm losing it on an attrition basis where it's not a planning. And one, somebody that I talked to recently that really was insightful is the thinking around the way recruitment is done, much more like college athletics coaches versus the idea of you know, like the sort of traditional world, I only think about the hiring. You know, hiring, when people that only think about hiring assume then that that person's going to stay with you forever. College athletic coaches assume they have a 4-year window, right? They know that they've got 4 years. They plan how they're backfilling their team. They know their players are moving on. They manage differently their resources. Yet, by the way, everybody, deliver excellence year after year because they have built a system around that. And I think too many employers don't think about people that way, knowing that there is a back end to that too. Yeah, I hope you can build great career paths and they stay with you forever. And I also live in 2023, and that's not how careers are built anymore. So why don't we do it to the playing field we've got, not some 1950s version of paradise that we think are in our head about what we're, you know, living in the old school.
Absolutely. And to follow on the sports metaphor even more, when you have those players in the coming in or they're being recruited in, you know that you're going to have to invest in growing them. You're going to have to invest in gelling them as a unit, as an organization. And you're going to have individual strategic coaching for the things that you want to be able to emphasize. And sometimes that's going to be bringing in trainers for technology. Sometimes it's going to be bringing in trainers for social skills. Social skills atrophy, just like language skills and coding skills, guys. If you don't use them, they do go away. They get rusty and cobwebby, and then you start saying something that has you on the front page of Reddit and not in a good way. So use them. Grow them, learn them, and if you don't know how, find somebody to teach you.
It's totally
for sure.
True.
Yeah. So I'm going to take a moment, put my coaching hat on, and then ask another question to take us into another hopefully interesting direction. So what I want to encourage everybody who's listening to this is to take what Dave is saying, and then also us, but Dave is our guest today, and he's saying some fabulous things. Take what Dave is saying and apply it through your own filter. So don't do the thing where it's like, well, I'm not an employer. I don't own a managed service business. That's okay. What Dave is saying and what we're echoing in what he's saying is applicable, even if, like, you're a manager of a software team. And like, especially if you're a manager of a managed services team, but it really doesn't matter, because when we're talking about investing in your people, when we're talking about knowing about the finances, when we're talking about growing your people skills, all of this matters too. And so this is one of these fun podcasts where there's so many different multiple layers to it. You might want to listen to it multiple times from like the perspective of, oh, okay, cool, I'm just going to learn some cool things. And then listen into it again from the perspective as the leader of a team. And then maybe you listen to it again, if this is applicable, from the perspective of someone who might want to become a business owner one day or wants to grow your own business. So that's what I love about this conversation, is it has so many different layers. So to add another layer to this, we've basically kind of have defined the cast of characters here, right? So we have the managed service providers, and we have their customers or clients. And then we have like the trainers who might be sort of like working for and working with everyone. One of the things that I love doing is thinking about the customers of the customers. Mm-hmm. So for example, it's like there's this managed service provider, and then there's my customers who might be a small business who's running a coaching business. Let's just say.
Right. It's a great example. Right? Where do we pull that one from?
Yeah, exactly. Don't know where that came from. So then it's like, from your perspective as the managed service provider, the IT professional, yes, think about your clients or your customer who is the business owner, but also think about their customers, their clients as well. And that can really add another layer to it, because of course that business owner is thinking about their customers. So if you're not, you're missing another layer. So I wonder to what extent, like Dave, you talk about this, think about this, if you could shed any more light on this aspect of it from the MSP perspective.
Yeah, it's a great area, because we talk a lot about the idea of going vertical in managed services providers. So becoming a specialist in a particular, you know, area as a, for your delivery. I had on the show in the past year an MSP who focuses just on life sciences, and in fact just focuses on life sciences startups, so that they can be really knowledgeable in the technology stack and the business outcomes there. And by the way, then understands all of the players that that life sciences firm has to deal with, from their VCs to their, you know, to the researchers, to the clients that are consuming on the other end of that. If you see it in legal, right, you need to understand, if you focus on legal, well, legal is really broad. You actually might be focusing on, you know, healthcare. And then so the through that channel is going to be the healthcare providers on the other side, the doctors that work with that. Or maybe you're looking at healthcare, and then that's going to be, what are the patient impacts? What kinds of patients are seeing that? Are you, you know, is it elder care? Is it pediatrics? Is it, you know, and what are the factors that go along with that? You can see it, and it gets really interesting when we get into the customers that are focusing on retail. Well, what kind of retail? Are you dealing with, you know, restaurants, which are going to have very different dynamics, you know, market dynamics than those that are doing, you know, clothing or you know, we get all the different types of varieties of retail, right? So going closer and closer to your customers and understanding their customers, by the way, links back to what we said earlier about being a good business analyst. You're going to need to go really deep with your customers. I find that you can go really deep in this area and be much more successful. It's not the only way to do this, but I tend to find that there is a correlation between some of the more successful providers and their investments in particular verticals.
Yeah. So going niche can be a really great way to go, then, is what I'm hearing you say.
I say it's both niche, and I also like to quip sometimes what I describe as boring. And what I mean by this is the more boring something sounds, likely the more profitable it is. Do you know anything about medical transcription processing for elder care? I don't know anything. And it sounds really boring. But you know what it also is? Like, super niche and very particular. And there's a very small list of people can actually deliver it. Like, and there's this sort of fun, and I mean it intentionally to be funny, is like, kind of the more boring it sounds, wow, the more am I specialized in it. And by the way, it probably becomes interesting as you go learn it and go deep into all of its subtleties. But the more it doesn't sound flashy, the more interesting. Like, people, you know, young people always talk to me all the time. Oh, do you want to be like, you know, because I do, we all, both of us are all doing YouTube videos. It's like, well, I don't want to be a YouTuber, but you know what I am? I'm a content delivery person in IT services for mid-market, that, you know, lower and lower mid-market and SMBs. And you know what? That just sounded really boring. But you know what? It also is a very specialized niche, right? And it becomes really profitable. So I'm to that point is like the more vertical you can go, yes, the more niche you can go, and tend to find those areas that are boring.
Yeah. I believe her name is Cody Sanchez. Speaking of YouTubers, she's a YouTube influencer and she's all about building boring businesses. One of her YouTube videos that went viral was about buying a laundromat. How boring can you get, but like super profitable and people need them, right? That's why they're profitable. So it's like, if you've never bought a business before, buy a laundromat is her thing, or other similar boring businesses.
And super, it's super automatable too. Like car wash is the same sort of thing. Like, cause there's a lot of, lot less machine, you know, a lot more machines and a lot less humans. Like these, again, they sound boring. Wow. There's some real money in those people. You know, another great business, everybody, vending machines, great business, right? Like, There's a principle here at work that to lean into that is very useful to remember.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, it doesn't have to be boring, especially when people need them. When it's something that's just part of our economy that people might just kind of ignore, like put your focus on that for a little bit and like, look, making money isn't boring. Your business needs to make money in order to survive too. And that's how you can have some fun with it. Well, so I love this.
Boring's fun to play with. But by the way, anybody that becomes an expert in something will tell you that it becomes interesting partly because of the complexity and the stuff you learn what you don't know. And it opens up. Like, again, we could poke at this, right? Like our vending machine example. Well, do you understand trucking supplies and supply chains and all of the various components that goes to delivery in that and all of the interesting stuff that can happen with weather and with timing and with location and there's theft and there's like, and as you get into it, it's like, well, actually there's some really interesting complicated problems to think about in this space that I did not think about.
Yeah, and that's so maybe where it sounds boring.
Right.
So maybe you want to work for a business or work in an area that initially sounds boring, then start asking the questions and realize that it's not.
No, yeah. And as you become an expert, you find that it becomes interesting on its own. When you become a deep expert in something, the subtleties really actually do become really interesting all of a sudden. And you figure out the like, well, can I get more efficient at something?
I have to warn you, you're talking to somebody with a PhD. So, you know, she's super, super niche things that you can be quite expert in. Like that's PhDing in a nutshell.
Hey, there's a reason why it's an advanced degree.
Yes.
That's right. For 5 to 10 years of your life, study one thing, go. Yeah. So it's like, everybody has their inner PhD. Everybody has their that desire for expertise, like that desire for learning. And guess what? Learning and teaching go together too, which is why I love the whole conversation around training. That at the heart of this, we're all trainers. We're all teachers. You know, and if you can embrace that part of you, I think you can have way more fun with it too.
I'm totally on board. And those, anybody that's doing sales also recognizes that sales itself, like good salespeople, are educators. They're spending the best ones are the ones that are literally just helping their customers or potential customers understand the problem and wrap their head around the problem and understand all the nuances of the problem. And oftentimes the end result of that is that's really complicated. I don't want to solve that myself. You are clearly the expert who just taught me all of this stuff. Please, Mr. Salesperson, make this problem go away.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like selling without selling. I love that.
That's the best sales technique, is just help them understand.
I famously hate the word just. Especially when we're talking about things in software or something like laundromats or order management or any of these myriad of things that have a short, simple name that allows us to believe that it's just that thing. Go do that. What's the biggest minefield people step in around you when they apply the just label to something? Is it, yeah, you just get an MSP? Or is it, yeah, I just need to hire an organization to do that? Or yeah, I'll just do it myself.
It's funny because I don't have a particular hang up on that. Because I actually, in a way, I sort of smile and I go, I always like it when people initially oversimplify, because it's, I know I have the opportunity to both impress and delight by walking them through all of that space. If they smile and go, it's just managed services, this will be fun, because you need the guidance to understand the complexity. And that is, you know, it is a opportunity to open the door and show them all of the pieces of that. And we alluded to it earlier with you know, somebody's going, well, I'm just a small business. I don't have anything for them to steal. Oh, yes, you do. And so I look at it from that perspective, is that my hangups there are the, like, I have to understand that if they have oversimplified the problem, it's on me to guide them through that education process they need to get to the end to fully understand the complexity.
Wonderful. Usually, so when someone's saying that, it's a member of my team that I need to educate on how we're not going to be able to turn that around in a weekend. I'm sorry. But I can see, yeah, if you're talking to a potential customer, a potential client, that's absolutely benefit opportunity to dive into something deep. So we talked a little bit about AI, we talked about security. What's another area that organizations tend to completely underestimate the complexity of?
It's a really good question. I think the piece that I have really focused on a lot is the speed of change. So technology is fun because we do move at an incredibly fast pace, but at the same time, we don't move at an incredibly fast pace. There are legacy systems that are still hanging around to this day that have been there a very, very long time, and I anticipate will be there for a very long time going forward. Most organizations are holding technical debt of significant size of, you know, for any size organization. And the bigger you go, the more you probably have some technical debt. And we think everything is moving incredibly quickly, yet at the same time, it isn't. And so for me, it's that balance of, and I say all the time on my own show, like I spend a lot of time now being an analyst, right? Trying to understand which of these trends, and I'm big on AI, and I think this is going to be completely transformative. And you know what I'm probably wrong on? The speed. It's probably going to take way longer for this stuff to actually happen broadly than I think it will. And I recognize that. I want to highlight that I think that there's opportunities to move fast for small organizations and they can pull really far ahead. But broadly, stuff moves a lot slower. And so I think that's the number one thing I would want to highlight is that this whole space moves way slower than most think. It doesn't mean that at a small level you can move very, very fast, but broadly it moves a lot slower.
Yeah, the gears turn slowly, but they're twisting and getting ready a catapult. It's the flying rock most people see, not all of the stuff that made that happen. And so a lot of things do move very fast in tech. If you don't believe me, just ask what the JavaScript framework du jour is. And oftentimes depends on the time of day that you ask that question to what answer you're going to get. But by the same token, large scale architectural principles stay true. Large-scale people management principles stay true. Large-scale project management principles stay true. What else do you believe is going to continue to stay true, even as AI, no-code, and other disruptive technologies start to wheedle their way into the minds of business owners?
I think the number one thing that's going to stay true is that we need frameworks to help make sure that this stuff is well-managed. We see it a lot in cyber, like in cybersecurity right now, the organizations that are super successful are the ones that are embracing frameworks. Generally, by the way, in the US, that's going to be one of the NIST frameworks, everybody. Like that's embracing one of the NIST cybersecurity frameworks. On AI, it's emerging, right? So that we're seeing a whole bunch of different frameworks out there. And I think on a compliance and regulatory perspective, it'll move faster than most of us are used to, because I generally believe that regulators have learned from their mistake from social media. And so they're going to come up with something. It may not be perfect, but it'll come up with something a little faster. But I think that for me, it's that area of frameworks is that, like, you alluded to it in terms of the way you were talking about the time scale. Our ability to implement frameworks against these technologies is really going to be the skill. And by the way, I'm going to circle that for every MSP listening, saying, that's your value, everybody. Do that. Do more of that. Please do more of that. Your customers will need that help, and it will be much more timeless and engaging and link back to their business outcomes better than anything else I can recommend you do.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And so we've got framework management, and then we've got being able to educate your potential customers and educate yourself on what it means to be a business, become a better business analyst to understand the business side of things as well as the technology side. What else would be part of your masterclass?
I mean, besides the obvious, like pimp my own podcast and say this is what I spend a bunch of time on my own show analyzing, is being strategic about that. I think there's a process for reviewing technology innovation and reviewing your service offerings on a regular basis and iterating through that. And oftentimes I look at telling business owners, I think you should be cycling through your services every 4 years and probably retiring portions of what you deliver on that regular basis. Because the market changes, your customers change, the needs change, technology changes. Like there's a whole list of stuff that changes, and what you built 3 years ago is probably not the right bit. And I get it. You will end up with the classic innovator's dilemma problem of not wanting to damage some of your existing revenue streams. But if you do that on a very regular basis and you're constantly cycling out a quarter of your services and cycling in new ones, you will build that innovation process that becomes a flywheel of its own that you're able to continually use in your business. And I think about that process a lot. And I like to highlight it, particularly for those of us in managed services, because we pride ourselves at being good at process. The whole point of delivering a technology on a consistent, reliable basis is that you invest a lot in process. Well, it extends that if you're very good at process, you should be able to apply those same skills to systemizing the review and creation of new services and the decommissioning and retirement of old ones.
For anybody from Google who's listening, that doesn't mean killing every single project that has, you know, not achieved massive global scale. That he's talking about smaller players who yeah, anyway.
So true. And we could have such fun making fun of Google today, but we won't.
Yes. Oh, wait.
They can take it too. They're used to it. So we covered so many awesome topics today. I have one more question, because after all, at the end of the day, we are career coaches for technical leaders. So I'd love to talk just a little bit more about your career, Dave, to the extent of which you're willing to share.
Oh,
and
sure.
Just to sort of kick that off, I'm going to take a wild guess and say that what you're doing now on a day-to-day basis in terms of, you know, how you're spending your time, how you're making money, how you're helping others is very different than what it was, let's say, 10 years ago. What caused that shift? Like what were some of the highlights in that shifting?
So my career, I've been at this for a little while, right? I got the gray hairs to show for it. So I have a degree in computer science, and you kind of laugh and go, like, literally, I was like, I'm a podcaster, YouTuber, and I spend more time in Adobe Premiere Pro than I spend in a coding platform, right? And so if you ask college Dave what he'd be doing now, oh, you'll be building products and writing code. It's like, I had no clue. It's a combination of taking advantage of opportunity and also life choices. And I think that's so if I look at my career arc, my first two jobs were late 90s tech startup fund, which was a delightful time to be in technology. I was a consultant to start and kind of product person. And then I was with a product firm second. And then when that went under, the lesson I learned was, hey, management gets to keep their job when things get tough, and they keep management and sales keeps their jobs, and technical folk get thrown out. I should learn to be better at selling. I should go do this myself. And that was the lessons I learned there. So I have a 10-year arc of building a business where literally it was around learning that side of things, right? And then grew that business, bought a company. It was a disaster, learned a lot, learned how I wanted to exit that business. And when I had the opportunity to sell it, I took all those lessons and I had a successful exit, and then I needed a job, right? It was that kind of, and I went to work for a software firm because it was more education. It was about learning how software companies worked in my space. So I was with one for 2 years and then another for six. And then did those runs. And it was also about like, well, what do I want to do now? Well, I want to learn something else. Like, I want to solve another problem. I think there's a problem in the media that covers our space. And I think I could combine my skills and be unique and sell ads and make some money and that combination. And here I am 4 years later with a podcast that keeps me employed. And then I can also trace back to the life moments, right? When I sold my business, it was, you know, I was 37 and I had the moment saying, you know what? When I'm 40, I don't think I want to be doing this. I just have that figured out. Like, I want it for my own brain. I'm going to want to do something else. And I kind of had the same thing, like, you know, with the last time when I switched to this, it was like, yeah, you know, I'm a couple of years away. When I'm 50, I don't think I want to be on planes as much as I am right now. And that's a personal choice too. And I think one of the things I always tell everybody that we don't think enough in these conversations is how the personal stuff matters in the conversations. Like, you're making career choices, not just based on like, what's a good move for my career, but also like, what's a good really move for my life. And that's a piece that has been part of my career choices.
So, so important. We often joke, maybe not even joke, that yes, we're career coaches, we're also life coaches as well, because you can't talk about your career without talking about your life. Yeah. And so very in the very beginning, you know, so for example, on our sales calls, I was doing them, Rob's doing them now, but when I was doing them, I was like, oh, how are people going to react to me asking questions about, you know, can I ask, are you married? Can I ask, how many kids do you have? Like, are people going to think that I'm poking way too much into their personal life? Of course, you have occasionally the person that might just be a little bit thrown off by that. But I was pleasantly surprised while people were like, yes, I want to talk about my life, because of course it's relevant to my career. And thank you for asking. So again, for all the listeners, it's like, yeah, look at the big picture. You know, what's the life experience that you want to have? What stage of life that you're at? I love that's been a part of your journey. And I can tell that it's been a part of what's kept it fun as well.
I'm totally motivated by fun. I don't mind saying, like, I know myself, and I know if I'm not having fun and I lose my passion real fast for it, and I'm not as engaged and my work's not as good. And that's a problem, right? Like, and I have to keep that alignment to make sure that I'm having a certain degree of fun, and orgs that don't match that are not a match for me. And that's okay, by the way. That is okay. Yes. There are lots of kinds of firms that I cannot work at. And like, I've learned about myself, I am not a big company person, right? And actually, that's more a flaw of me than it is a flaw of the company. I really admire people that can manage those big companies, can manage that stuff. That's not me. I don't have those bits. So I've got to lean into the bits that I do have and the talents that I do have and find places where that is of value.
Yeah. So important. Know who you are, know what you're good at, know what you want, know what you don't want, know what you're not good at, and find that sweet spot. And that's really what it's all about. And it can take a lifetime. It can take a whole career to peel that whole layers back and be like, this is the thing, right? This is the thing.
But and yeah, find the thing that you can deliver that people will pay for, that has value, yes. Right? Like, I rebel against this whole idea of go find your passion. Nah, find the things you're good at and hone them in a way that people will pay for that because it is valuable. Not just like the thing you're passionate about. Find the areas you can deliver value that with your skill sets that others will compensate you for. That's
love
the
that. Alignment. Love that. So great. So great. All right. Anything else, Rob?
I mean, unless we want to talk about Mass Effect, I think we're going to be ready to.
That's the next podcast.
That's the next podcast.
The whole gaming podcast. We'll do that on after hours or a weekend. That's a whole other story.
Hell yeah. You know my number, Dave.
If people want to follow you, Dave, what's the best place? So it's the Business of Tech podcast. Did I get that right?
Yep. The website is businessof.tech, where there's a big blue button if you want to find it on the podcast or platform of your choice. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Spotify. I'm on Apple Podcasts. I have a daily version of the show in newsletter format. I got a weekly version in newsletter format. You pick your format. I'm on that, but I always direct people, find me on your favorite podcast platform and listen to the Business of Tech.
Love it. Love it. And I love that, like, you are a professional podcaster. Like that can be, it's like a model for people. It's like, oh, can I just be a podcaster and make money and live a fun life? Yes, absolutely. Here's one piece of evidence right here.
It is possible.
So, I love it.
You have to run it like a real business.
Yes.
It is an actual thing. It has a profit and loss statement. It's, you know,
for
but,
sure. Yes.
But
I think that's why it's like,
possible.
Oh, podcasting doesn't work. That people aren't looking at their P&L. I don't know how to spell P&L. So
exactly.
All right, Dave. Well, it's been fabulous talking with you. I am going to look at my crystal ball and say that I think that we will be talking again sometime in the future. But yeah, for now, thanks for your time. It's been a really great conversation.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to the next time we connect.
Excellent. Awesome. See you soon, Dave.
And that wraps up another episode of the People Stack podcast. Thanks for listening and for supporting our mission. We are all helping to positively transform the tech world, one tech leader at a time. I have so much gratitude for all of you, for our badass clients, our loyal listeners, every one of you who we've worked with. And I have to give a special shout out to my husband, Rob Allen. He's my co-CEO, the love of my life, PeopleStack Client Zero. And it is such a fun ride, finding new, ridiculously unreasonable levels of prosperity, joy, and fun with him every single day. And a quick thank you to Ketza for creating the catchy, inspiring theme music that we get to use in our podcast. We love each and every one of you. Big, big hugs, aloha, and mahalo.